Well, hi there, Jonathan Dorwithy for part two of this live seminar presentation to parents that I recently gave. And if you've had a listen to the first part, we explored the key issues for young women and some of the big picture stuff. In the second part, we're going to look more at the issues facing our young men and particularly some of the challenges they're facing at this moment in history. And I'm going to finish off the presentation with some broad general ideas on parenting and just some tips that we've seen work over the years. So I hope this has been really useful to you wherever you're listening to it. I'm Jonathan Doyle. Check the links after the talk to my books and other options in terms of having me come and speak at your event. But I hope this has been useful to you, and I really look forward to speaking with you again really soon. We're looking for stickiness tonight, just one idea. Favourite saying of mine, you don't need a whole bunch of great ideas to change your life, just one good idea that you're actually prepared to use. So we're just looking for that one idea. So let's press on with, that was just a snapshot of what's happening for the girls, three simple strategies. At the end, we're going to hear if anybody else has some others that are really working. Young men will be outrepresented in the following areas: violent crime, sexual crime, suicide, domestic violence, drink driving, car fatalities, depression, and of course, risk-taking behaviour. Is it your boys? No, but it's a snapshot of what's happening culturally. Now, a couple of things you're probably already across. If you look at the last one and the third last one, we'll join them up: drink driving, car fatalities, and risk-taking behaviour. If you are not across this, just behind the plate of bone at the front of your head is the prefrontal cortex. Last thing that Charles Darwin gave us on the evolutionary journey, it's the higher order thinking structure of the brain. It's one of the, so the back of the brain is the animalian brain. Right up the front is one of the things that has made us so unique as a species. It's where you do all your higher order thinking. Fully developed in females around about mid-teens to late teens. Fully developed in the male, early to mid-20s at best. Karen says mid-30s. So, developmentally, this section of the brain where the highest order thinking structures take place, risk-taking behavior, drink driving. So we have a culture that gives our boys three dominant ways to prove manhood: lose your virginity as fast as possible, drink as much as you can, and be physically intimidating. You join that with a prefrontal cortex that's not fully developed. Massive surges in testosterone. So I'm just throwing out the big picture again here. Testosterone in the human male peaks at 2 and again at about 16, 17, 800 times what it was at birth. Plateaus till about 32 and then begins a slow decline. Slow decline. Woke up on the morning of my 32nd birthday. Karen's like, "You all right? Just hold me. just want to be held." So join the dots. Most boys in year 9 or 10 at this school, for most of human history, would have been married and have had 2 to 3 kids. Industrial Revolution, infant mortality changes, a whole bunch of complex factors happen. So now they hit their sexual prime at 17, their testosterone prime. If they marry at all, they won't do it statistically till around about 32. So they have this long journey of managing testosterone. So remember I said that the key issue for girls is the question: am I beautiful? Am I desirable? We mightn't like that question, but it does explain a fair bit of behaviour. Boys don't have that question. Boys' question is different. It's just as powerful. Am I strong? Do I have what it takes? Am I okay? Men's greatest psychic terror is failure and embarrassment. So in marriage counsellors talk about psychic terror for men is, you know, sort of impotence on any level, whether it's physical or professional, career-wise. So this question in men: am I strong? Am I competent? Do I have what it takes? So boys carry that question. For most of history, it was usually validated by the community of men, and we'll get to that in a minute. That's just not happening. So they carry this question in a complex social structure, and they start looking for ways to get validation. And most of them, unfortunately, are not what we call pro-social. So I love that you can tell how my brain works. I'm always at the level of the big picture thinking, right? With hundreds of thousands of boys, I've just simply reduced it to this. As men, or as boys, we have extraordinary biophysiological strength. Our bone density is different. Our muscle mass is different. Testosterone is an anabolic steroid. That's literally what testosterone is. All a man has to do in his life project, and this is one worth remembering, it's this simple. Your entire life project as a man, I think, eventually boils down to this. What will you do with your strength? It's the fundamental question of being male. Now, you look how this plays out culturally, from bikie gangs to booze and alcohol to all these different ways that men try to be male in the world. And then we get a Peter Cosgrove or a Weary Dunlop's biography I read recently, or a Mandela or a Maximilian Kolbe or a Fred Hollows. We see these men that eventually sort of move their life project into an externalization of their strength in the service of something bigger than themselves. So this is the meta project of raising boys. Culturally, they're trained to take their strength, internalize it into negative behavior. And we've got to teach them to become outward focused in what they do. Now let's make it even a bit more complicated. Back to Kay Himowitz, who I mentioned earlier, a very powerful book she wrote recently, Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men Into Boys. Now that sounds harsh on women. It's not how the book's actually, I think, they have to get a title that shocks everybody. The book is about nothing other than really the Peter Pan syndrome, which is that our boys are avoiding the channels of manhood that were there for millennia. So boys now can drift on into boyhood indefinitely, the Peter Pan syndrome, avoiding the kinds of commitments that they would have been involved with for millennia. You can see some stats here. It's a percentage of unmarried males. Now, you can have all sorts of opinions on that. You can say, well, men, marriage isn't the be-all and end-all. You don't have to get married. I'm going, whatever. It's a massive social change. In 40 years, think in 500-year time blocks, think in 1,000-year time blocks, that is a seismic change. And it's personified in simply what Kay Himowitz would call the man-boy syndrome. So, and it's captured quite beautifully here. So with Hamish and Andy, who are, I would say, enormously funny, they actually, in terms of, so many comedians are offensive and divisive. These guys are quite talented and quite funny. But what they do is they behave like 15-year-olds in the bodies of 30-year-olds. And they're a great snapshot of what our boys are tending to do is avoid the kinds of commitments and stepping into the current of manhood and commitment and contribution and service, and it can just drift on indefinitely. Add to that, of course, the advent of the internet having a huge effect on boys in terms of things like pornography. If you're interested, there is a brilliant book called The Shallows by Nicholas Carr, which explains really how the internet is really becoming a major game changer. We want to be across that with boys. Often I'm asked about gaming and the, very small amounts of time that they spend on gaming. This is from The Lancet, the world's most prestigious medical journal. So very simply, when they watch violent content, so I don't know how across this you are, but on YouTube you can see anything on the planet in milliseconds. Rape, torture, murder, beheadings, anything. Anything in milliseconds. It's not neutral. It elevates cortisol levels in the brain. It changes all sorts of stuff. You can see here from The Lancet, one study among millions of, bits of research on this now. What we see affects it. I mean, if that's not true, why have art galleries, right? There was a beautiful movie many years ago with Jodie Foster called Nell. Have you ever saw it? But it was about this girl. It was a true story. It was a girl who was sort of, her mother died. She was in the backwoods in the US and she was like wild. And these researchers found her. And there's this poignant moment at the end of the film. And I was watching it. I don't know who I was watching it with in a theater. I was playing first grade footy. I was a man's man. I was all choked up, man. I was watching this going, damn, man. What happened? Images on a screen changed my physiological state. I was affected by what I literally saw, and it changed my physiology. So we know that the kind of material that many of our boys are seeing is having that effect. So it is okay as parents to go, I don't want you to see this. And explain to them why. I love you. I care about you. This stuff. And they won't thank you. Not for a long time. I mean, I just have these visions of you going home and them going, you know, you're right. You know, really, it's just, I've been so blind. My cortisol levels do feel elevated. Okay, so there I was a couple of years ago working at the King's School in Sydney. I used to go up there and do a program for the boys there, year 10 boys. I used to fly up there once a fortnight and do all this stuff for their boys. It was great. At the end of the first session each time, I would take anonymous questions. And they would write them all down because I'd work with them over 2 weeks and I'd fly back the next week and do a bunch of other stuff and go through the question. And as I was sitting in a taxi on the way back to the airport, I was reading these questions and one of the questions had such an effect. I can see myself sitting there when I was going through them. And the question was this: how do you talk to girls? Now, can anybody see the problem with that? Can anybody in the room see why that struck me so much? What was so interesting about, unique about that? Let me frame this a bit differently. At King's, you're dropping 30K a year to get your kid in the school. Anybody see the problem with asking that question? Why are you asking me? You're in this incredibly cosmopolitan first world city. You've got affluent parents, and it's a great school. They really do fantastic work. But no one is talking to him, and no one is answering these deep questions. So the image that I came away with that's captured a little bit there was that many boys, not all, I am given to hyperbole, many boys are deeply, deeply alone. So who's got boys in the room here? We've got heaps, great, okay. So as they move into this peak of sexual development, all this stuff happening, the question is, who's talking to them? And if you're a dad in the room, and if you're married, the word husband, interestingly, comes from, it comes into Old English from the Nordic. And it translates, originally the etymology is husbander, which has had a big impact on me. Really simple idea. It's another great one to take away. The word husband comes from husbander. And husbander simply translates as the one who dwells in the home. Post-industrial revolution, dads, and again, I'm not insensitive to relationship breakdown and lone parenting, but for many dads, you know, we're away, we have to be away, and I'm away at times. But when we're home, are we genuinely at home? Are we a strong presence in the home? Are we a dynamic, alive presence in the home? A couple of quotes from Richard Rohr. Another one from Richard Rohr again. So this is a poignant moment for me because I am very sensitive to lone parenting and the great work done there. But so much of our problems are coming from either absent or ineffective men in the lives of boys. Mostly it's because we carry deep pain and ambivalence from our own father-son relationships. We did not receive the love, the encouragement, the affirmation that we needed, so exactly where are we supposed to be making this up from? Some men press on and do a great job anyway, but it's really good for women to know this, that men often carry deep, lifelong wounds of rejection, abandonment, pain from their own father relationships. Not all, okay? There's definitely men that would say, no, Dad was great. You're in a minority, and that's great. Anybody recognize this face? This is Christian Barnard, world's first heart transplant. Brilliant surgeon, beautiful story in Singapore at a conference on a panel. A guy told a story about Barnard. He read a line from his book where he said, this is a direct quote from Barnard, where he said, "When we were children and we were sick, our father would doctor us. I had ingrown toenails that pained me so much I would cry. My father would make a poultice of sunlight, soap and sugar and draw the poison out. When we had colds, he would get Vicks and rub it into our chests and sit with us until we fell asleep. And on Sundays after lunch, my father would take me for a walk to the dam above our town. We would sit there and look out upon the village, and I would speak of my problems to my father. He would speak of his to me. And I always say to audiences, you know, is it a coincidence that he went on to become a specialist in the heart? Interesting idea. Boys need men. Engaged, slightly dangerous, crazy, passionate, alive men. And they're often not getting them. So if you're lone parenting, again, you have to find the courage to find these men and ask them to be engaged. And if you are a happily married father who's incredibly busy with your own, be sensitive to those who don't have that and think about how you might be able to make a difference. So our boys are carrying, here's another paradigm for you, this deep question of identity, boys' questions. Who am I? Am I okay? Around, you know, sexual drive, their bodies, they're alone, many of them. Can your son tell you everything? I don't know the answer. I can say to parents, make sure your children can tell you anything. As much as traumatic as it could be, make sure, if your best you can, to your ability, the relationship is at a point where you can go, I don't care what you do, what the body count is, you can tell me. I will probably be angry, but we'll find a way to work it out. So boys carry these deep questions. So in the absence of it, what I mentioned before is the boys are looking for this big three. I don't know everything, and there might be counter theories, but 300,000 young people and written books on it and blah, blah, blah. The big three, lose your virginity as fast as possible. Virginity becomes a massive source of embarrassment for our boys. It's, and I'm, you know, I have a joke with the boys in seminars, and if I remember, I'll do it tomorrow. I have a slide changer with a big green button in the middle. And I say to the boys, you're all terrified of virginity. No, I'm not. No, I'm not scared of it at all. It's a thought experiment. Imagine I press the big green button on the count of three. Every male virgin in the room glows. Three, two, and the boy's like, no. It's because culturally they have so few ways to be men and to transition into men that sexual conquest, and I simply say if that's the case, what attitude to sexuality and to relationships with women are they bringing? If virginity, so you can just invert it and say you could raise boys in the paradigm of virginity is a source of masculine strength. It's a gift you possess, which you bestow at a time of your choosing in a relationship and of appropriate dignity. I mean, one definition of the word chastity, now I'm not doing a chastity talk, but there's a beautiful definition from it in a certain catechism that says, chastity is an apprenticeship in self-mastery where the couple wait to receive each other as a gift from God. An apprenticeship in self-mastery. Beautiful line, wherever you're coming from. Is sex bad? No. Is it evil? No. Do I stand in front of hundreds of kids and say, if you think about sex, you'll die? No. But what I'm trying to do is drag it out of a pornographic culture and elevate it into something quite extraordinary and beautiful again. Lose the virginity as fast as possible, drink as much as possible, and be physically intimidating and be strong. But the strength gets externalized into intimidation and violence. It looks like this, at least on the sexuality side. The research I did on this was when I was doing the second master's. I did a really high-end master's in philosophy and marriage and family studies. And I was sitting in a lecture theatre doing it with one of the best guys in the world on the philosophy of love. And this really was coming to mind because I was flying a lot, several times a week. And Qantas was running 2.5 men with Charlie Sheen multiple times a week. So I'd get it in the morning and then back in the afternoon. 17 million viewers per episode in the US, 1.71 million viewers per episode in Australia. So I began to think, okay, let's go out into all these homes where dad isn't there, boy sexuality is peaking, his interest in matters of human sexuality are peaking, and this stuff is pumped in as a mainstream media format. And I argued that there were three key points being communicated in every episode. One was that women exist for the purpose of sexual conquest. So every time the door opens in Two and a Half Men, if you've seen it, every time a new woman arrives in the show, when she stands in the doorway, how is she framed as a person? Her value is her potential value as a sexual conquest for Charlie. I always found that fascinating in a kind of post-feminist era that we would have mainstream entertainment formats where that wasn't being challenged, particularly by women. Number two was the most important thing about a woman is body parts. These are the first two. So all the language in the show was, and people go, Jonathan, relax, just a TV show. No, when, you know, close to 10% of your population watches it daily, and they're unsupported by men or women who can give them other paradigms and other ways of being human. But the big kicker, which was simply to say, can you think of another place in our culture that really impacts boys where those two messages are presented incredibly powerfully? And if you can't, it's fine, but it'll give you an insight into where we're traveling culturally, because that's exactly the script of internet-based hardcore pornography. So what makes Two and a Half Men sort of so interesting is it's a pornographic belief system pumped into a mainstream media format. Like what I'd call a softening up campaign. You get a culture to go, oh, that's funny. Well, then we can't be shocked when horrendous stuff's happening on the internet because we kind of all slept through this. The last one, of course, that doesn't appear for some reason is simply that commitment is death. The most terrifying thing for Charlie in the show was that commitment is death. What every man in this room knows is that your life has been profoundly shaped, more than anything else, by the commitments that you made. You know the truth, and the truth is that the commitments haven't killed you, the commitments have made you. The deepest commitments of your life, relationships, fathering, have been the making of you. So this stuff is just wrong. It's just backwards. It's not how the world really is. And finally, in case it sounds like a rant, think of that belief system coming through the program and how pornography is impacting kids. Here's a simple question. Back to our young women. Think of a young woman that has a traumatic sexual experience. Now, on the Gold Coast, it's now Tuesday. It will happen probably tonight, but there'll definitely be one this weekend. Somewhere in this vicinity of 50 kilometres either side of where we're standing, some young woman is going to experience sexual trauma in the next few nights. The question is, what's the relationship between that experience and the likelihood that she'll be treated in her life for mental illness related to sexual trauma? Now, this is where I'm going with this. What I'm trying to do here is draw this kind of link between boys not being mentored, formed in their relationships with women and sexuality, and where it ends up. And this is from an extrapolative study of 8 million women aged between 15 to 80. University of New South Wales and several overseas universities did this about 3 years ago. Here's the average, in Australia, your average woman who has never experienced sexual assault has a 1 in 5 chance of being treated in her lifetime by a mental health professional for depression, anxiety, bipolar, you know, and this could be postnatal, it could be any number of factors, grief, trauma, that sort of stuff. Now, a girl that has a traumatic sexual experience, it jumps to just on 70%. In her lifetime, she'll be treated by a mental health professional for mental illness related directly to that experience of sexual trauma. A girl that has 3 experiences jumps to 90. So what I'm getting at here is a culture that's not raising and mentoring boys and pumping these belief systems in is going to get certain outcomes of which we can be justifiably concerned. So 3 ways to prove manhood: sexual conquest to women, alcohol consumption, look at that, 43,000 alcohol-related assault. So you see what I'm getting at? If we give boys booze, porn, PlayStation, alcohol, sexual conquest, we've got to give them something else. So the question becomes, what can we do about the identity question? And now it gets a little bit more positive. Again, I hope I'm doing this in a balanced way. Is it every boy? No. Is it every home? No. But can we just stand back and look at the great big cultural messaging we're giving, that we're accepting and we're allowing to take place? So if your son carries this deep question that he's not telling you about, because you won't go home tonight and have him go, Mother, Father, suddenly aware of this deep existential question that I carry about what does it mean to be a man? No. But watch what they do. And we are talking to Dirk tonight on the way here. Just look at the behaviors. Always look at the behaviors. What do the behaviors want? What's the behavior after? So the good news is, how do boys become men? And the good news on this is there is the closest thing to consensus that you find in the soft sciences. You don't get much consensus in research, right? Everybody's got a counter theory. The one on this is that sociologists and anthropologists tend to pretty much agree on this one. From South America right through the Pacific into Africa, how do boys become men is simply that manhood is conferred, manhood is bestowed. How do boys become men? For most of human history, it happens when the community of men or their father tells them they are and marks it in some symbolic way. And some of you will go, oh, is this the initiation story? Yes, it's the initiation story, because we're not doing it and boys are trying to do it themselves. When you see them in a V8 doing burnouts, do you know what that is? Please validate me. Please validate me. I have a deep internal strength question. I need to do burnout so that people can see that I'm strong. That's what's happening. When a guy drinks half a case of beer or a case of beer, he's not doing it for the flavor. He's doing it either to numb pain or he's doing it to get validation. And we can bypass a lot of that work if mothers, and particularly fathers, will consider a process. When do boys become men? And most of us in this room, probably as men, never experienced. So many of us see me at the end having different ways spent our lives doing certain things, some of them fine, to get some of that validation. I stopped round about late 30s. I wish I'd stopped long before. In case you think it's just an interesting idea, you recognize this one. That's Tiger Woods with his father, Earl Woods. A whole bunch of stuff going on here, but I play a lot of golf, and I read the biography recently by Lee Haney, who was Tiger's swing coach for 6 years, and they didn't end well after the big breakups and things that happened for Tiger. But he tells a story in the book about when Tiger had a bad knee injury. And I used to say to audiences, do you know how he got his knee injury? And everyone would snigger. I go, no, not like that. You wouldn't know this, but he, every weekend when he wasn't competing, he seriously was training with the US Navy SEALs. He was obsessed with the US Navy SEALs. He had connections, he'd do all their training, live fire exercises, knew all the guys. At his home on Jupiter Island, he would plug in with a headset and play US SOCOM Navy SEALs for up to 8 hours at a time. Part of that was managing stress. Now, why the obsession? Well, this is Tiger's father, who is a Green Beret Special Forces colonel in Vietnam. Well, there's an interesting coincidence. I'm a billion-dollar athlete. I've got a trophy bride. I'm probably the second-best player in history. Am I okay, Dad? Just an interesting theory. Am I okay, Dad? The father-son relationship will condition so much. And I'm recording this tonight, so I'm not going into detail, but I can tell you it's true. World's greatest basketball player quit basketball at the peak of his career. Anybody know what he did? Blew everybody away. Tried to make it as a professional baseballer. What sport was his father utterly obsessed with? I bought a book in Canberra Airport this morning on Michael Jordan, biography, and I'm reading it. And the book is actually, yes, about the skill, but it's about the complex personality. And I'm reading on the plane flying here today, and this amazing line where when he was about 10, his brother was very mechanically minded and his father was very mechanically minded. And the story in the book said that Michael would often go out there, but he was useless with mechanical stuff. And time again, his father used to turn to him and yell at him, you get inside with the women. There's a whole lot to that, right? There's a whole lot to that. It's dodgy in multiple levels. You get inside with the women. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to drive myself for the next 40 years of my life to show you that I am unbelievably capable. Really? It's just... And some of you go, well, maybe that's okay, because look at the outcome. Well, look at what happened to Michael Jordan's relationships and a bunch of stuff when he hit 45, 50. The hunger in the hearts of boys to know that their fathers love them, that they're okay, that their fathers rejoice in them. Yes, their fathers will knock their heads together if necessary, but you're okay. I'm proud of you. I love you. I want you to become a fine man. The good news is it can be done. And there are four steps to doing it. And I'm going to show you how it's done. Very quickly, we'll have a quick break. We'll talk a little bit about the pornography issue, and then we'll get you home. Four steps. And look, all I'm pitching here is that if we do this, this is going to be somebody's, most likely someone's spouse, yeah? You're touching the future generation. This little boy now, my little boy's five. And I fail and I'm just stuff up, but I'm constantly trying to get this stuff right. Love him well. Number one, this is from all the anthropology studies. How do boys become men? Number one, they're separated from the community. We take boys away from the day-to-day. Now, I'm going to pitch this to you as something you should really do. I'm going to suggest there is a place you can do it. But this is the initiation process. You take the boy away with the community of men. Ring your brother and say, hey, let's go and go for a camping holiday or do it yourself. Some of you will just take to this like ducks to water. Some of you will have deep wounds from your own fathering relationship and you'll be like, I'm not an outdoorsy type. I don't know what to do. I probably won't get to meet you again, so I can just say this. Your pain is less important than their future. Your pain is less important than their future. If we have wounds, part of the burden on us as men and fathers is to find the healing and the growth that we need so that we can love them in the way that they need to be loved, as hard as that might be. Richard Rohr tells a great story about an African tribe. This is a true story where the boy is born. He lives with his mother till he's about 12. And he knows who his father is. He sees his father occasionally. But around about the age of 12, he wakes up one morning and he can hear this unusual chanting. And he comes to the door of the hut, and about 50 meters away, he sees all the men of the village, his father, his uncles, every man he knows. Boy had no idea what's going on, but they're all chanting the same thing over and over again. And it's really cool. They're standing there chanting, come out, son of my people, come out, son of my people, come out, son of my people. The community of men calling the man from the boy. I mean, seriously, how many 25-year-old behemoth boys have we got walking around where the man was never called from the boy and they don't know how to be men? Because being male, I think, is about being self-sacrificial. It's about loving. It's about externalizing yourself in the service of something bigger than yourself. And the mother's job, she stands in the door of the hut. She's in on this, right? Her job is she chants back, he's not here. The one you're looking for isn't here. Her job is to keep him back in the community of women. Now, hear this right, because I can lose people here. Mothers, you can't walk away tonight going, well, Jonathan just said that only fathers can... No, mothers have an incredible role. Interestingly and non-politically correctly, there is lots of research that says when boys are studied closely and they go, you know, they're asked about different attributes of mum and dad, one of the most powerful things they link to mum, anybody guess what it is? Food. They go, mum, food. And many other things besides. But mum lets him go. He flies out of the door of the hut and he runs to the community of men. That is a beautiful image. The boy being swept up into the community of men. Stage two is they take him to a place called liminal space. Liminal space is simply where boys' BS doesn't work. So boys coming into adolescence are going to run any kinds of patterns, right? Bigger boys will run physical intimidation patterns. Intellectual boys will run intellectual patterns. Boys will run any kind of patterns to protect their vulnerability and frailty, right? So they run foul language patterns, whatever pattern it takes to bristle up and protect a very, very soft psyche. Liminal space is where the men put the boy somewhere where they don't know what's going on. Here's a simple example. Think about boot camp for the US Marines. When they get off the bus, the drill sergeants don't go, hi, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Marines. We've got a lot of options for you today. We're going to have some haircuts. We've got a few different ones you can have. If you want to keep it a bit longer, that's fine. You just let us know what you'd like. And then we thought we'd go for a run, but we don't have to. We just have a vote, all right? If you've ever seen Google, YouTube, go to YouTube and go, yeah, Marines boot camp. They just want to just yell at them, right? They just scream at them. Everything is about, and you can say it's terrible and it's all sorts of awfulness, but basically it's about breaking down their sense of control a bit. So they're like, I don't know where I fit. I don't know where I fit. So boys in some way have to have the crap and the BS and the patterns broken down. Stage three. So just simply in traditional tribes, they'd leave them on a rock for 3 days. So the men would take them away, put them on a rock and just walk off. And the you can try that. Apparently it's illegal, but but some of you, they're going, man, I like this talk tonight. That's really good. So the boy sits there for 3 days. What do I do now? What do I do now? All of it is a way of going, you know what? You are not one of us. They had to reinforce the idea, you're a boy. We're the community of men. You're a boy. We have to reinforce that knowledge. He has to feel that sense of I'm not with them yet. Stage three is they're tested. Now, that's just one simple little thing, but in the Sepik River province in New Guinea, they cut them over 1,000 times. They often bleed to death. Again, I think that's illegal. You can't do that. Many teachers have said, is it possible to try it? And I said, no, you can't do that. But they've got to be tested. Come on, as men, don't tell me, but many of you have had times in life where you were tested. We did it in sport. We did it in ways where we wanted other men to see that we could do stuff, that we were competent. And finally, once they pass the test, they return to the community, but they're given a new name. They're given a new identity, which means as your son transitions through this process in the home, there has to be some way of marking what he does or how he's different. Different to his siblings, different to the treatment he got before. You know, now you're a man, we expect you to do X. So in the absence of that, and none of that happening culturally, they try to take it by force. And again, the anthropologists agree, you can't steal manhood by force. So they run all these patterns, alcohol consumption, driver's license, cars, speeding, sexual conquest. Sport can be a positive one, but they'll use aggression, increasingly pornography, and I've misspelt that, but my favourite at the moment, tough stickers, tattoos. Show hands, who thinks we've seen a spike in tattoos last 5 years? Huge. Get off the train today. Sorry, have you got tats? Not saying anything. But I got off the car, out of the train today, and this guy, this young guy, about 16, his big family thing tattooed right around his neck. I'm going, dude, getting a job on Wall Street is going to be hard. But all I say is that, you know, the traditional cultures finished the initiation process with tattooing. And pick somebody like a Todd Carney, who seems to be having these huge internal problems of transitioning into an authentic manhood, but he's absolutely covered head to toe with an externalized manhood, with a depiction of manhood. Enough said, because I don't want to lose people on that topic. But I say to boys, as I'll say tomorrow if I get a chance with the U11 boys, this is what their grandfathers did to prove manhood or to be men. Not all of them, but different ways of being men. So again, take one idea away. Our task as males and in raising sons is to be self-sacrificial, and we fail at it. This is the great Christian project, again, is that we recognize that we want to live the ideal, but we need help to do it. You know, the greatest battles that I've learned as a man have usually been in the kitchen sink. Get off a plane at, you know, 9 o'clock at night, and, you know, 3 kids under 3.5, an exhausted wife, and come home, and 1 minute I'm, you know, flying around the world, the next minute I'm scrubbing pots. Serve. Just serve. Beautiful man, a very dear friend of mine who died tragically a year ago in his sleep. Incredibly wise man, wonderful priest. Came to dinner once when Karen and I were staying in Sydney, and he said, we were having a long talk about all this stuff, and he said, Jonathan, be a donkey. I said, pardon? Be a donkey. He said, what do you mean? He said, think of those old-fashioned water wheels, right? They used to tether a donkey to it, and the donkey would just go round and round in circles all day just turning the water wheel. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, what the donkey never sees is it's turning the water wheel. But downriver, it's irrigating crops. It's feeding people. It never sees it. It just turns up every day. He said, Jonathan, be a donkey. As men, there's times we just got to turn up every day and serve and serve and serve. And we got to, so I got a 5-year-old son. I got to teach him that now. Just serve your sisters. Take your plate to the sink. So this is all sounding really heady, really big picture. Every little interaction in your home raising your children is character formation. Take your plate to the sink. Don't let your mother carry that. Do this. Pick that up. Do that. Serve, 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 serve. That's how you form character. They said to Aristotle, How does a courageous man become courageous? Aristotle said, simple. He does courageous things. You become what you do, and your children will become their choices. It's a slide I do at the end. They become their choices. I have 9 minutes left. I'm going to imagine, please, if you will, a really horrendous series of slides about the neuroscience of pornography addiction. It's really bad, and it goes for a long time. I'm not going to do it because we're out of time, but I'm going to give you links to all the stuff that I have done. I've got a whole big free online resource. If you want to learn more about that, I'll give it to you for free. It'll be on the link that Dirk sends you. Very simply, pornography is a curriculum. It's a curriculum. I spoke in federal parliament with Professor Marianne Layden from the University of Massachusetts, world expert. We did the sessions together, and she kept saying, it's a curriculum. If men and women, mothers and fathers, won't teach young men about sex and human intimacy and love and romance and gentleness and pornography will be a curriculum. It teaches a belief system, a normative belief system. You can't stop them getting access. You can't. You can do some smart things in the home. Computers shouldn't be in the bedroom. Computers should be in the main area of the house, screen facing outwards. What you can do is go, here's why this stuff is dangerous. Here's the vision I have for you as a person. Here's the person I see as you of you being in the future. So with Aiden, it's going to be this gentle process as he emerges into adolescence and older, just gently chipping away. Pornography is a killer. It's a killer, friends. The neuroscience is extraordinary. And I don't want to keep you back tonight to go through it all, but if I'm up here again, I can do that session for you, but I'll give you the links. So as promised, how to completely make your child perfect in 7 minutes. That was Dirk's brief. He said, can you meet every parental need in 7 minutes? And I said, of course I can, sort of. We're looking for one idea. Just remember as you leave that you're in the character formation business. They'll remain nameless, but I chatted to some of the parents tonight, and you know they're sharing a story of having to take a stand on something, and you've all been there when you've got to take a stand on something, and they don't go, that is a wise and noble decision you have made. I bow in deference to your magnificence. Every interaction is character formation. I have 3 under 3.5 now, 3 under 6, and they're just at it all the time, at it all the time. Aiden, you can't hit your sister. For the 50th time, you can't hit your sister. It's character formation, and it's thankless, and it's endless. Don't apologize for boundaries. You'll know if you're being draconian, and if you're channeling, if you had a really authoritarian parent, and that's all you know, and you're locking down, you'll know. I think you'll know. And your spouse, if you have a spouse, they'll tell you usually. But boundaries are psychologically healthy. If no one else tells you this, I hope you've read this somewhere. Boundaries are psychologically healthy. The absence of boundaries for adolescents is traumatic. It increases anxiety and uncertainty. Boundaries. This is what we expect. This is our story. This is what we stand for as a family. This is what we value. And I love you enough that this is where I stand on this. And you may not thank me, but some point in your future, you know, you can say this to your kids, you will. So your son or daughter will become what they consistently choose. Things like, you know, again, like pornography and all that sort of stuff. We become what we choose. It's incredible power to have, and it's one worth educating our young people about. 4 minutes to go. Educate, I'm big on time. I have to keep it right to time. Educate yourself, learn as much as you can. Make a decision tonight, just go, it doesn't matter who didn't come tonight, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world's doing. For this 10-year block, from the age of about 10, and yes, if you can do stuff early, that's really good. You know, if you can fight a lot of your battles pre-10, that's great, about Facebook and about computers and about that sort of stuff. But this time between 10 to 20, especially those early teen years, identity differentiation, right? So the work that they're doing, according to Erickson, all the big child psychologists, is who am I? They want to relate to the peer network. You want to become experts. Learn as much as you can. Just say to yourself, right, he's right. I've got 10 years. I've got this window. I will give you some links. If you're taking notes, there's a brilliant book, Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters. Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters by Meg Meeker. I'll put a link to that on the follow-up for you. My wife has a stack of books this high on parenting. She's just relentless. just endlessly learning. So learn what's going on for them. How is social media impacting them? What's pornography doing to them? Just learn, 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 learn. Big one here, affirmation. If you are married, encourage each other. Often in parenting, how often, I don't know if you do this, but if you said to each other recently, you know, you do that really well. You know, you're great the way you do that. Sometimes Karen will say to me, you're a really good dad, and I'm not always, but she'll say, and I say nothing. But I'm walking away like, affirmation is oxygen for men. Affirmation is oxygen for men. We probably won't tell you, but for us to hear from spouses, you're doing really well. Hey, why don't you spend a bit more time with them? They really want to spend time with them. Why don't you take them out? Why don't you go do this? Affirm each other. Just say, you know, I love the way you do it. It's a little thing. It's a simple, practical strategy, but this is a tough job, right? It's a thankless, tough, difficult job. And you don't want to be doing it all the time without anybody saying to you, hey, you're having a crack, you're doing well. So affirm each other. The danger of what we call autonomous rooms. As they go into that season of identity differentiation, they're going to want to just bury, some of them are going to want to bury themselves in their room and differentiate against you. We don't want autonomous rooms. So if they have a computer in their room, here's what I would suggest you do. Step one, go home and watch the opening scenes of Saving Private Ryan, the Normandy invasion part. Then go and tell them the computer's coming out of their room, because you'll be suitably prepared. Because it's not like they're going to go, hey, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that. You know, why have I got this computer? You get that out of here. You take that, you crazy cat. Not going to happen. But computers in the rooms, especially for boys. My son's a really good boy. Your son is human. And his biological sex drive is probably peaking the next few years. And the internet offers him challenges that were never there before. You don't trust me. No, I love you. I love you so much that I don't want you to have unfair pressures on you. And some of you go, no, we've really talked about it. I trust him. That's fine. But this separation off, hiding in their rooms, I hope you know, most social media activity for adolescents happens between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. The highest use of social media for adolescents between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. No, my phone's off. Yep, sure it is. Now, a couple more really practical ones. Love this one. Make your home the hub. While your children are adolescents and even younger, all the social traffic should be going through your house. You came tonight, and you came because you care, and you're in the game already. Decide, okay, if you're an introvert, I'm an extreme introvert, all the traffic needs to come through your house. You need to know every one of your child's friendship group, everyone, and ideally their parents. You need to have barbecues, you need to do stuff. We are in the middle of an epic home extension, huge swimming pool going in, all of it being done around this idea of building family and traffic through the house. So the pool will be ready in a couple of weeks. So all the kids from preschool, year one, come for a swim, you know, come when it's 30, 40 degrees, come for a swim. Our place becomes the hub. So I often say, you know, get an old table tennis table or a pool table and whatever it can take to transform your house into a hub where young people want to be. North Queensland, many years ago, principal at the end of the night said, any feedback for Jonathan? What did the parents think? What did you think? Guy put his hand up. He was a truck driver, I found out later that evening. And in that voice, that accent, it's far, far North Queensland. He goes, nah, it's been great. He goes, I'm going to go home and tell me missus, some bloke from down south said, we got to buy a pool table. And I said to him, I said, oh, yeah, that's great. I said, that's not quite what I meant. He goes, nah, that's what I heard. So if there's any men here on their own, you can't go home tonight and go, and if your wife goes, your spouse goes, you know, what did you learn? Oh, this guy, he said we had to get Foxtel. Otherwise, you know, seriously. So I just want to leave you this idea. Do you know their friends? Do you know all of them? And on this, and I've alluded to this a couple of times tonight, there's a good chance that some of you in this room will have a ministry to someone else's children. Some of you, like your daughter, will bring in friends who are quite broken and vulnerable, and their experience of men's been terrible. And because you're okay as a bloke, you'll be able to be affirming and in a non-threatening way. You'll just be a strong male presence, and you can I was lucky to have several families like that in my adolescence that were wonderful, and women too, you know. You might just be an incredible mother to someone else's children at a pivotal time in their life. So that's one strategy. Just think about that. What can you do? Buy, borrow, possess, steal, remodel. And a woman said to me quite beautifully in Perth last week, she said, it was a very affluent school, very affluent, and she felt she couldn't compete because they lived quite simply. And they were like, you know, all the other kids had amazing houses and their kid was like, oh, they don't want to come. It was really poignant. But I actually think that doesn't matter. If the home is a place, if you're just positive and happy and it's a vibrant place, they'll come. Put stuff on. Know who their friends are. Know the parents. Really simply, be with them. Make a decision in the busyness and the chaos of the lives you have at the moment to be with them. Go for walks. Go out for ice cream. So I'm big on spontaneity at the moment. I'll just like push myself. Like I'm crazy road cycles, do a huge amount of cycling. And I'll get boxed on the weekend, really tired, come home after 3 or 4 hours on the bike. And everything in me wants to just crash out for the day. And I'll do a little bit of that, but then I'll be like, I'll just perk up and have an espresso and go, right, let's go. We're going to go do something, you know, just being together. Have a spontaneous lunch together and go, we're all going for a walk. And then I'll go, yeah, no. We're going for a walk? No. But just be with them. Think about it. What could you do? What little rituals and things could you start to do to be with them? Well, you know, all of Karen's books that she's read just talk about relationship, just consciously, deliberately building a relationship. Almost done. Some simple rituals. This comes from a beautiful book, and I'll try and put the link in for you, called Simplicity Parenting. And if you want to be an expert, read that book, Simplicity Parenting. It's just about really simplifying your lives in general and the flow-on effect that has on kids. Meal times, candles, thanks, prayer, silence, affirmation. Everyone go, dude, seriously, this would never work. It does. It just takes time. So in our family, 3 under 6, we sit there, we try to say a prayer together, and we have 30 seconds of silence, complete silence. 95% of the time, it's a complete debacle. A three-year-old, it's just like they can't do it, but we're building a ritual. It'll take 15 years, but we'll get there. What are you thankful for? Silence, affirm each other. Just simple rituals you can start to build in and just start them. You may not have its effect for another generation, but just start these things. Wind down rituals before sleep. TV, internet, massive studies, some of the ones out of France that I've seen. Brainwave patterns do not return to normal for up to 2 hours after TV's turned off. 2 hours. So they go, I just want to chill out, watch a bit of TV before bed. No, brainwave patterns, 2 hours. When I was in the boarding school, I had 100 boys in the boarding residence. I could get 100 boys to sleep on my own. Basically, it was a bunch of cues and signals, lights off at this time, TV at that time, now do this, now do that. And they don't thank you, but they get on a process, you know. So don't let them just go internet, 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 I'm going to bed now. Give them those wind down rituals. I'm sure you understand this. They need at least 10 hours of sleep. One idea in simplicity parenting was mobile phones. Make a box. All phones in the box by 9 p.m. Family thing, just go, we're going to make a box. Why? We just thought we'd make a box together as a family. We're going to decorate it as a family. And then we're going to put all our phones in it. Because you don't want to give them the chance for social media too late. A real favorite, boys associate emotion with movement. Most times if you go to your son, how's school? How's your day? Mums will often say when they're driving in a car that boys will talk. So men tend to associate communication with movement. Example, men in the room, if your best friend rang you and said, let's go for a latte, you might be like, okay. But if you're sitting across a little table like this and he's right there, yeah, you can sort of. But if you've got golf clubs and you're walking together, you can talk for hours because you're not talking there, you're playing golf. But often men need to move. Ian Lillico from is a boys expert said he used to come home and every day his son would be like, you know, how's school? And he said one day he came home, his son was shooting baskets out the back of the house. Came around, didn't say a word to his son, just started shooting baskets with him. While they were shooting baskets, how's school? So boys associate emotion with movement. Last one, descheduling. This is from Simplicity Parenting. You've probably been sold on the hyper child. They must have cello lessons, underwater billiards, whatever it is, 450 activities because they've got to be perfect and get into Harvard. No, they've just got to be loving, happy human persons capable of contribution and living well. So be cautious about the more activities. Oh, young people need boredom. When they're too on board, good. Boredom is a great thing. Spontaneity and having to come up with other ideas. How much unstructured time do you have on weekends, you know? Just times where the house is just, everybody's just not doing anything. So allow yourself, and just on that, dropout rates for organized sport, 90% by year 11, depending on different cohorts. So just be it's okay to question, are we doing too much? Are we just bought into this whole hyper-parenting, everything's got to be, you know, we've got to do everything. So friends, I'm done for time. What I do now is I stand here for as long as you need me, if you want to come and ask me any questions one-on-one.
Well, there you go. I hope you found some really useful ideas in there. As I said at the start of this second talk, you don't need a whole bunch of great ideas to change your life. Just one good idea that you're actually prepared to use. Parenting is a seriously challenging task, but I still think it's just about the most important thing we'll do in this life. So hopefully on the website here where you're listening to this, or maybe on iTunes, you'll find a link to the books that I've written and other options in terms of having me come in to speak or work with your organization. So I'm Jonathan Doyle. I hope it's been really useful, and I hope you can grab some more content really soon.